This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
we, the Committee to Protect Journalists, have condemned the exclusion by the Trump campaign and have asked the campaign to reconsider and to allow journalists access. This is the Washington Post, after all. This is a mainstream media news organization. And excluding journalists because what you don't like, what they write, as a candidate for the highest elected office in the United States, seems petty. It seems vindictive.
That's Rob Mahaney, Deputy Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, responding to presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump's ban of some media organizations from covering his campaign. We'll have full details coming up.
Also, a UN monitor says the border clash between Ethiopia and Eritrea last Sunday is unusual and dangerous. And relations between Rwanda and Burundi continue to deteriorate after nearly 3,200 Burundians were deported from Rwanda in less than a month.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Egypt reports today that one of the black boxes from Egypt Air Flight 804 has been pulled from the Mediterranean. The aircraft departed Paris on May 19th and is believed to have exploded before plunging into the sea. All 66 passengers and crew perished. AFP reports the cockpit voice recorder was broken into pieces, but experts have retrieved the recorder's memory unit. It keeps track of conversations and other sounds within the flight cabin. Search teams are still trying to find the flight data recorder, which collects information on speed, altitude, and direction of the plane.
A rights group says more than 400 ethnic Oromo protesters died in a security crackdown by the Ethiopian government earlier this year. Human Rights Watch says the casualty figures are based on more than 125 interviews with eyewitnesses, bystanders, and protesters. The report accuses police of using live bullets and firing without warning on protesters in Addis Ababa. The government's own investigation estimates 173 protesters died during the confrontations. The Minister of Information says the HRW report is very generous with the numbers. The clashes began when members of the Oromo ethnic group objected to plans to expand the city limits, threatening to take possession of surrounding farmlands. In the face of the violence, the city cancelled the expansion plans in January.
Ethiopia and Eritrea continue to blame each other for instigating Sunday's clashes in the border area. The former UN coordinator of the monitoring group for Somalia and Eritrea, Matt Bryden, says the recent confrontation is a very unusual and a dangerous incident. Haroon Maruf of VOA's Somali service asked Bryden if Sunday's clashes were inevitable.
No, it wasn't inevitable. It is inevitable that on a disputed border there will from time to time be low-level problems that might involve patrols from one side or the other. But the escalation as reported, the number of troops and the types of weapons involved, this is a very unusual incident. In more than 15 years since the conclusion of the armed conflict and the cessation of hostilities, I don't think we've seen any incidents on this scale.
But was this isolated, or do you think it could lead to a more consistent conflict?
Well, it is very dangerous, and there are always risks that something like this could escalate. As we saw in 1998, the conflict arose out of initially some very low-level clashes. But as I said, I don't think that either government right now has a particular interest in escalating the conflict. Eritrea is embarking on a policy of engagement. It is trying to attract foreign assistance, particularly from the European Union. It is claiming that it will make efforts to stem the migrant exodus from Eritrea through Sudan and Libya towards Europe, and is therefore engaging in a kind of international charm offensive. Ethiopia as well has maintained the status quo for many years. It has had several opportunities recently to instigate conflict if it had chosen. The defection of several hundred fighters from the Tigrayan People's Democratic Movement was one such opportunity, and it hasn't done so. So it's hard to imagine at this stage what Ethiopia has to gain by provoking a new border war.
Do you think other issues in the region, like Somalia's situation, may be a factor?
I don't believe so. There was a time when Somalia was a theater of proxy conflict for these two governments, but the level of direct confrontation on both sides has reduced. Eritrea, which used to openly support the Union of Islamic Courts, and for some years Al-Shabaab, has either stopped supporting Al-Shabaab or has found ways to make that support invisible or less visible. The United Nations monitors have reported several years in a row that they haven't found any evidence of Eritrean support to Al-Shabaab. So I don't think that there's anything happening in Somalia that could contribute to an escalation of tensions between the two governments.
Do you think the two countries, militarily, economically, do you think they can sustain another full-scale war?
Well, Ethiopia is certainly better positioned to sustain a conflict. It has a much larger economy. It can sustain larger troop numbers. It has a much better equipped army. Eritrea, its population is much smaller. Most of its military are conscripts and therefore probably lacking the kind of motivation of a volunteer army. They have been under an arms embargo now for about 6 years, which has constrained their ability to arm and sustain their armed forces. So I think of the two, Ethiopia is in a better position to sustain a conflict if one were to erupt.
That's Matt Bryden, former UN coordinator of the monitoring group for Somalia and Eritrea. He spoke to Haroon Maruf of VOA's Somali service.
Relations between Rwanda and Burundi continue to deteriorate after nearly 3,200 Burundians were deported from Rwanda in less than a month. Moses Havyarimana reports.
Many of those who've been deported by Rwanda are in Burundi's Kirundo province. There, I found Nyandwi Jacqueline, a mother of two children, in the town of Bugabira. She says she left her 7-year-old daughter in Rwanda after being forced to leave the country. Jacqueline says that she went to Rwanda to work after divorcing with her husband 4 years ago. She says that the husband never supported her needs and she decided to go and work in Rwanda to earn a living. Many Burundians have already integrated with Rwandans, especially the bordering communities, which almost speak the same language. Jacqueline says she was never given a chance to go back home to pick her belongings. Jacqueline says that soldiers took her out of her garden and was told to leave the country. She says she had to go with her young child, who was with her at the time. She says it was a long journey and had to cross a river to enter Burundi. Rwandan authorities say those who were deported failed to legalize their stay in the country. But people who live in the border communities said they used national identity cards to move between the two countries, either to visit or to work on farms. Daruhije Nestor is a 61-year-old man who lived in Rwanda for more than a decade. His wife gave birth during their 2-week journey by foot back to Burundi. Nestor says all young men and women were put on trucks and dropped at the border. He says that they had planted beans and were told to leave without harvesting them. Nestor says he left most of the belongings behind, traveling with his wife and two kids. Burundians who were deported from Rwanda were left with uncertainty about their future. Nestor talks about his journey to Burundi. He says they arrived in Burundi, but the next morning, his child couldn't walk. He was crawling because of the long journey they traveled, which took them almost 2 weeks. Mukandori is the local administrator in Bugabira, explains how those deported from neighboring Rwanda were treated. She says that those deported are those who were directly forced to move out of their daily work activities because many wore working clothes, and many say that they were not given a chance to go back home. Whether you leave your family behind or property, they just don't accept you to go back home. She says that even those who had their legal documents at home were not given that chance. Rwanda says it currently hosts more than 80,000 Burundian refugees. The Kigali government says it is seeking to move the refugees to a third country. There have been allegations that Burundi refugees were being trained to attack the Burundi government. Rwanda has repeatedly denied these reports. Violence in Burundi began in April 2015 when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he will seek a third term in the office. His opponents called it unconstitutional and violated the Arusha Peace Accord. Hundreds have been killed in the violence and hundreds of thousands have fled to neighboring countries. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, in Kirundo Province in Burundi.
President Obama has arrived in Orlando, Florida within the hour. He's expected to meet privately with the families of the 49 people killed in Sunday's gay nightclub shootings. The AP reports he's also expected to meet with first responders, doctors, and paramedics. White House spokesman Josh Earnest says the president's visit has nothing to do with the man responsible for the attack, 29-year-old Omar Mateen. He says the president intends to show the country stands with the LGBT community in Orlando. The investigation of the shooting continues. The motive for the attack is not clear, although there are several theories, including mental illness and the possibility that Mateen was conflicted over his own sexuality. The Associated Press reports CIA Director John Brennan says the agency has found no connection between the gunman and any foreign terrorist organization. Six of more than 50 people wounded in the Orlando attack remain in critical condition. A study released this week by Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy says Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, has disproportionately benefited from news coverage of his campaign. In spite of those findings, Trump has regularly complained the media has treated him unfairly. Trump recently announced he is banning the Washington Post from campaign events. That expands the list of media organizations he has excluded to about a half dozen. The Committee to Protect Journalists, a New York-based nonprofit that promotes press freedom worldwide, condemns Trump's actions and has called on him to reconsider the banning of media. Rob Mahoney is CPJ's deputy executive director. He spoke with me about the ramifications of Trump's actions against the media.
The actions of the Trump campaign to exclude certain news organizations from covering the campaign send a very bad signal to all governments around the world that might think of doing something the same. The difference is that in the United States, just because a particular journalist or a particular news organization doesn't have accreditation to cover the campaign, that doesn't mean that they can't actually report on what's going on, and accreditation doesn't necessarily mean access. Therefore, here you could get access to officials around Trump. You can get access to some of the materials of the campaign, even though you're not credited. If you go to countries in Africa, this is much more serious, and the general public depends on news, can be deprived of news and information if independent organizations are excluded from government officials.
should U.S. reporters respond then to Mr. Trump in this vein?
Well, I believe that one of the strongest things that they can do is to stand together. We, the Committee to Protect Journalists, have condemned the exclusion by the Trump campaign and have asked the campaign to reconsider and to allow journalists access. This is the Washington Post, after all. This is a mainstream media news organization. And excluding journalists because what you don't like, what they write, as a candidate for the highest elected office in the United States, seems petty. It seems vindictive. And so what I'm hoping is that they will change their minds. The journalists themselves, we've seen in the past where once a particular journalist was excluded from the White House press corps, other journalists banded together and said, this cannot happen. I think it was Fox that was excluded. And Fox was allowed to go back into the White House press room. Journalists have to stand together on this in the United States, just as they have to stand together to push back against restrictions on them doing their job freely in any other country in the world. There's no difference.
How do you think governments of these African countries who have harassed and banned journalists, how do you think they are viewing Mr. Trump on his stand against the media?
From our point of view, what this does is it gives authoritarian leaders an example to point at. So if I am the leader of a country in Africa, for example, and I don't like what a particular news organization is doing, I could exclude that news organization's reporters from access to the Prime Minister's office or the President's office. I could exclude that person from access to officials where they would get information. And if someone like me were to say this is unfair, they could say, well, look, this is what's happening in the United States. The candidate for the presidency of the United States is doing this. What difference is there between what he's doing and what I'm doing? So it sets a very bad example.
If Mr. Trump should continue, say if he does become president and he continues in this same vein of not allowing some media outlets that he does not like to cover him, do you think this will change journalism or the way news is reported here in the U.S. and internationally?
Well, the big difference is that we are now talking about Donald Trump, a candidate for the office. So he represents only a section of opinion in the United States, and he is campaigning. If he becomes president, he is the president of all Americans. And at that point, he cannot exclude individual news outlets without there being some consequences, because what he is doing then is trying to control the access to all shades of opinion represented through the media to the president, who is the president of all Americans. So it's a very fundamentally different situation between being president and being a candidate.
That was Rob Mahoney, Deputy Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He spoke with me from New York City.
South Africa is marking 40 years since the Soweto student uprising that marked a pivotal turn in the fight against apartheid. As the nation looks back on the tragic, violent protests, South Africans young and old say their nation is better for it, but still far from perfect. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Soweto.
The tragic events of June 16, 1976, were a major turning point in South Africa's fight against the apartheid system. President Jacob Zuma on Thursday recalled the horrors of that day, known then as the Soweto Uprising, and today celebrated as Youth Day.
Heavily armed police opened fire on the students as they were marching peacefully towards this stadium. Had refused to disperse.
On that day, some 20,000 high school students protested in the segregated township of Soweto to protest the apartheid government's insistence on teaching in the Afrikaans language. Police opened fire on the marching children. Estimates vary on how many children were killed. Some go as high as 700. One of the first victims was 13-year-old Hector Peterson, whose name today adorns a museum on the site of the massacre. Many of the surviving students are now grandparents, but the memory has never left them. Upa Moloto is today a project coordinator in a foundation centered at the museum. The 58-year-old was among the marchers that day and said he initially mistook the gunshots for firecrackers until he saw the boy next to him bleeding. He paused when asked, "Was it worth it?"
My kids got education from multiracial schools. To them, issues of color, issues of race, they are not entrenched like when I was growing, because when I was growing, issues of race were the key, they were determining. Yes, I do agree there's still a long way to go in terms of getting rid of apartheid. I mean, it has entrenched itself in economy.
One legacy of apartheid is that black students remain significantly poorer than their white peers. University students highlighted that argument when they launched protests last year demanding free education. That debate continues. Many who protested in 1976 say they have no regrets. Florence Kanye was an 18-year-old high schooler at the time and participated in student protests in the city of Bloemfontein. She says police gave her a lasting reminder of her activism.
Even now, I have a pain at my back that is from the effects of that time. Now, I have that pain that doesn't go away. Sometimes as that pain comes, it will go, you know, right down. It's from the beating, because in those rooms that they were locked us in, before they took us where they were locking us up, they were beating us with something like a plank.
If anything, she says, the experience galvanized her. Today, she is the principal of a Catholic school in Johannesburg. She emphasized education with her own two children, she said, beaming as she told of her oldest, who is now a university student. It only seems fair on this historic day to give the last word to a young person. But since he is only 15, we first asked Vladek Nlovu's parents if it was okay for him to speak to us. Then we asked him, what would you say to your parents and to your grandparents?
Let us thank them for what they did for us, because we have freedom. We can do everything in this country.
He smiled shyly as he told us he wants to become a lawyer when he grows up. For Moloto, Kanye, and Zuma, that was an impossible ambition in a nation where black students could not go to top universities, could not live in or even visit white neighborhoods, could not vote, could not become president. 40 years later, for Ndlovu and his friends, nothing seems impossible. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Skip Sisk, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Africa, this is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, I, yeah, yeah. This one, I, yeah, yeah.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.